The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
We got a few interesting dilemmas here, and I want to figure out what they are. First of all, what's the topic? Parents, right? Honor thy father and mother. What number are we up to? Five, right? Fifth commandment. So what's my problem even before I start? In other words, we pointed out that there are two tablets, and it seems as though the first list, believe in God, idol worship, not taking God's name in vain, that these are all a list of commandments that allow me somehow to develop my relationship with God. And we looked at the second tablet, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. And we perceive them as a list of things which focus on my relationship with man, with my fellow human being. Right? Not to steal, not to kill, not to adulter, not to covet. So, not to bear false testimony. So, the question is, how does respect for your parents fit in here? Now, I will grant you that anything that relates to your fellow human being relates to God. And anything that relates to God relates to your fellow human being. And yet, nonetheless, it's not accidental that there are these two lists. So I got to figure this out. What bothers you? You read the Pasuk, right? What does the verse say? Somebody? Honor thy father and thy mother. Is that all it says? That your days may be long. Well, I don't know if everybody wants long days, but okay, whatever that means. Longevity. We'll have to see what that means, right? So what bothers you? Okay, how come if I honor my parents, I specifically am given longevity? We've got a couple of processes we have to go through before we even ask that question, if you think about it. Which are what? I mean, what is this idea here? What, the Torah is nervous? God saying, well, I'll tell you what. Me, I understand you want to honor. But your parents, ooh, who wants to honor your parents? It's hard to honor your parents. They're annoying sometimes, aren't they? So God says, well, I'll tell you what. I understand that honoring your parents is difficult. So if you honor your parents, I'll give you long life. Of course, why do you have long life? So you can honor your parents. Go figure. Why am I being given a reward? And it's very interesting, there are only two commandments in the entire Torah where the Torah expressly, for a specific commandment, gives me a reward. This is one of them. We'll have to take a look at the other and see what it is. Why do I need a reward? And what does the reward mean? Because if we want to ask this question, we have to ask an additional question. What does this mean to honor my parents? What is kibud? What is honor? Bearing in mind that any English translatory word is never going to be complete, what does it mean to honor your parents? And for that matter, since we mentioned the question of a reward, so it seems, longevity, so what does longevity mean? What does it mean, v'ha'arachta yamim? And your days will be long. What does that mean? What does it mean? L'man yarichun yamecha ala adama. Right? Look at this verse. This is a very strange verse. Kabed et avicha ve'et imecha. Right? Honor thy father. Really it means that there's no English translation for the word et. Right? It's part of the definitive article, but really the hey is the definitive article. So don't try. Right? And that's why you'll find this same word translated tons of different ways all over the Torah, because it means different things in different contexts. So let's say that it means not honor your father, but honor this thing that I'm now going to mention, your father. And this thing that I'm now going to mention, your mother. So there's a superfluous word here when you think about it. And you don't pick this up in English because there's no translation for the word et. Right? Why do I need the extra v'et? It should just say, Kabed et avicha ve'imecha. Honor your father and your mother. So the rabbis get really interesting. They say, well, you know what et is? Et is lirabot et achicha agadol. Right? To include your older sibling. Very interesting. You have, according to the rabbis, according to tradition, perhaps even a biblical obligation to honor your older sibling. Now some of you, maybe the oldest, and this pleases you, And some of you may not be, and this might perturb you, and we won't get to discuss this because we don't have the time for it, but if you're curious, this is a very interesting detail. I am the middle. I'm the middle child. I didn't know when I was young that there were all these complexes about being a middle child, so I didn't get them. If I'd known, I would have, right? But I'm, you know, what they call the best part of the sandwich. You know, you put the two pieces of bread, what defines a sandwich? Well, it's a salami sandwich, it's a peanut butter sandwich, so that's me, right? So, you can imagine, because I have an older brother, and this occupied some thought processes for me, you know, when I was young. Still am young, right? So I put a little effort into considering this question, and I want to tell you there's no way out of it. You have a biblical obligation to honor your older sibling. And the Talmud even discusses specific examples. But I'll give you a break and I won't go into them. But now, go back to the rest of the sentence. Leman, in order that, Ya'arichun Yamecha, your days will be lengthened. And that's what everybody says is the reward. But of course, the verse doesn't end there. So let's take a look at what the reward really is. It's not just that you should have long days. It's Leman Ya'arichun Yamecha Al Ha'adama, on the ground, literally, Asher Hashem Elokecha Noten Lach, that God has given you. Now that's a very interesting sentence. What does that mean? Does that mean that when you enter the land of Israel, which is the land that God gives us as a people, so you'll have time in Israel because you respect your parents? Or does it refer to the general term of ground, land, in other words, this world? In other words, physical life. And if that is the case, and that seems to be the opinion in tradition, then that brings me to another question. Anybody want to guess what that question is? I mean, if I'm going to get a reward in the Torah, if the Torah is going to say that for the fulfillment of a given mitzvah, you get X, so what would I not expect that X to be? Something physical. Because it appears that the whole Torah is geared towards teaching me that this physical world is not an aim, but a means. It's a temporary vestibule to the world to come, whatever that means. And everything physical in this world is not supposed to be long-lasting. So on the one hand, I'm told you're going to have longevity. And on the other hand, I'm told in the physical world, why would I want a physical reward? Especially if I've already gotten up to the fifth commandment. So I know that there's a God, and I understand the purpose of my existence, because I'm not taking God's name in vain, and I'm not bowing down to idols. And all of a sudden now God says, but if you honor your parents, so I'll give you some physical reward. Who wants physical reward? Or is it physical reward? So that's my next question. Yeah. Now that's a very interesting thought. If I honor my parents, I'll get long days. And if I have long days, in other words, a long life, then I'll get to be honored by my children. I got to tell you, and some of the rabbis discussed this, some of the commentaries, I still got a problem with this. Because I have a general problem with the perception of reward in general. You know, my dad just celebrated his 62nd birthday, Baruch Hashem. And he, you know, he came to Israel about 4 or 5 years. My parents came to Israel, they made Aliyah. And we all thought he was the director of something called USY for like 30 years, and he... incredible what he achieved, what both my parents achieved. And we figured, great, he's coming to Israel now. You know, my parents talked about Aliyah for a long time. It took the first grandchild to sort of seal the deal, right? And within a year, they were on a plane, right? Of course, we went to Pittsburgh that year, but such is life. But anyway, what are you going to do? But we came back. So he did the opposite. In other words, he came here so that he could do more work. So he works like 3 different jobs, and he's involved in Jewish education, and he works at the Jewish agency, and with this and that, and he loves it, whatever. But because of that, I'm busy, he's busy, we don't get to spend enough time together. So I said, look, you know what, it's your 62nd birthday, whatever, I'll take you out, right? Good idea. Perfect present. You know what the perfect present is? Present that you give somebody that you can enjoy. So this is, you know, very altruistic of me, you know, to give my father a meal that we can enjoy. So we went to Norman's. Ever hear of Norman's? They bring you out. It's a, you know, I asked my father, dairy or meat? I knew the answer, but you have to ask the question, right? You know, do you want to go to like a milchik place, a place where we can have a nice lasagna, little fettuccine, something nice? Or do you want to go somewhere where you can eat raw meat, right? So my father's like meat. So we went to this place, and they bring you a hamburger. It could be a cow. I mean, it does everything but moo. It's incredible. It's huge. It's like it's called a mega burger. Baruch Hashem. So we sat in this place, right? So we sat in this place, you know, and we ate. And, you know, it was very nice. We had a really good discussion, a really good time, whatever. And I fulfilled the mitzvah of Kibud Av Aim. No doubt about it. I fulfilled this mitzvah last night by taking my father out to dinner for his birthday, just by sitting with him and talking with him. And I had numerous opportunities during the evening to fulfill the mitzvah. So I opened the door for him, and I took his coat, and I sat him down, and I paid for dinner, and I paid for dinner, and I paid for dinner. You know, I mean, I had numerous opportunities to, right? So I do this so that one day my kids will take me out to dinner? I mean, there is truth in that, but is that why I should do a mitzvah? As a matter of fact, the Ramban, Nachmanides, right? 13th century, so he says that this verse somehow implies the opposite. Now, how he does this is very tricky. And it really, to be honest, the point that he makes is valuable. How he gets it out of the verse is very difficult. And you can almost sense that the Ramban is very uncomfortable with this idea. Because how could I have in the Torah, in the Ten Commandments, the idea that I'm doing something for a reward? As a matter of fact, there's a magnificent Mishnah in Ethics of the Fathers, Pirkei Avot. What does it say in Pirkei Avot? It says, Al tiyu, don't be, ke'avadim, as slaves, hamishamshin et harav al manat lekabel pras. Don't be as slaves who serve the master in order to get a reward. Heyu ke'avadim hamishamshin et harav shelo al manat lekabel pras. Right? Rather be as slaves who serve the master, right? Not in order to get a prize. Now there's an obvious question there, but before we discuss that, the Mishnah is very clear. The whole goal of my relationship with God, with Torah, with mitzvot, with my fellow human being, is that what I do, I don't do for a purpose. I do it just to do it. I don't say hello to somebody because I want them to say hello to me. I don't say hello to somebody and smile because I want them to be nice to me. I don't even, this is a higher level, say hello to somebody because it makes me feel good. I say hello to somebody and smile because it's just good. Because that's what you should do. Because why wouldn't you do something that's good? Of course you want to do something that's good. Why not? Why could, how, what would cause a person not to do something that's good? But if I'm doing it only because it makes me feel good, well, that's a very dangerous thing. First of all, there are many things that are good that don't make me feel good. Or at least we think they don't make us feel good. And there are many things that I don't perceive necessarily that I'm receiving something in return, even though I really am. So there's something lacking. So it's true that there are different levels. What does this tell me? What does this mean? Now, since I already mentioned the Mishnah, I have to point out to you that there's a difficult question in the language of the Mishnah. Anybody pick up on this? Something doesn't fit. Half that Mishnah, well, half of that two-sentence part of the Mishnah that I quoted you, shouldn't be there. I mean, if the Mishnah already tells me, don't be as a servant who serves the master, in other words, as I serve God, right, in order to get a prize, don't be like that. That should be enough. Why does the Mishnah have to tell me, be as one who serves the master in order not to get a prize? Right? What is that message? So we'll get back to that. But that's a problem. So now, let's get back to Kibud Av Aim. So what is Kibud Av Aim? What is respecting your parents? So let's first come up with a definition, then I'll take any more. I see some of you have comments and questions. Let's first take a definition. What is respect for your parents? I have an interesting dilemma here. The other day, a guy came to meet me. He wanted to know about Israelite, etc. What he really wanted to do was he wanted to go to yeshiva. He's finishing off his stint in Columbia University and his BA. And he's decided for various reasons that he really wants to get into some serious Torah study. He has some background. So he wants to find the right yeshiva. So I said, okay, you know, I mean, I had taught him 5 years ago in the summer. And I taught his brother a little bit. And so when he came to visit his brother, who's now studying here, Both of them decided it would be a good idea if he talked to me, so fine. So I told him, come by, whatever, and I'll walk you out. And we walked out of the old city a few days ago. So I started talking to him. I said, look, it's very hard for me to advise you. And, you know, the first question is, are you sure yeshiva is for you? So after a while talking to him, I realized he knew what it meant to go to yeshiva, and it was really what he wanted. So, okay, fine. So then the question is, well, what yeshiva is right for you? So I said, look, I can suggest you a few places that might fit what you're looking for, you know? So I said, I'll give you an example, you know, of one yeshiva, and I'll give you maybe four or five different ones, and you'll see whether this one fits. So I said, there's a yeshiva that I actually worked at, and it has a very healthy and open environment, and it has a balance between, you know, the perspective of an open world and the perspective of Torah, and science is not a negative, but science enhances the world, and it's an intellectual place, and it isn't the yeshiva that thinks that that success is preventing a person from going to university, but that views it as valuable when a person goes to university, and all of the rebbeim have been through the army, and they've all been in university, and they have MAs and doctorates, so that this really might fit where you're coming from. So he started smiling. So I said, why are you smiling? He said, well, I think I know what you're talking about. So he said, you know, yeshiva Miftar, Bravendus. So I said, yeah, that's that, because he knew. I didn't realize he knew that I taught there once, whatever. So I said, yeah. I said, it's not the only yeshiva like that. There are a couple of others, but yeah, that'd be a good place. He said, it's funny. Everyone I meet tells me I should go to this yeshiva. That's what he said. He said, everybody I meet. He said, even when I was in Colombia, I met a couple guys. One of them had been to a different yeshiva. He said, you should go to that yeshiva. So I said, okay, you know, so you're answering your own question. If everybody's telling you that, you should check it out. I don't know if it's right for you, but go check it out. He says, well, there's a problem. See, I was here for 2 weeks checking different places out. So I said, oh, so you went to see it? He said, no. I said, oh. He said, well, I promised my parents before I came that I wouldn't go to visit this place because it's in the territories. So I said, wait a second. I said, first of all, you're staying with your brother in the yeshiva in Alon Shvut, which is also in the territories. It's 10 minutes away. So he said, yeah, well, because my brother was staying there, my parents couldn't tell me not to stay there, right? But I promised them I would only leave this place twice during the whole 2 weeks that I'm here, and they arranged their whole trip around this. He said, I didn't want to, you know, transgress. I didn't want to violate what my parents told me to do. So I said, well, how did your brother do this? How did your brother end up in this yeshiva if your parents don't let you go? He said, well, my brother's already, you know, 22, 23, so he does what he wants. So I said, wait a second. Here's a guy, the older brother, who's been in yeshiva now a couple of years. Went back, finished university, came back, now he's in yeshiva a couple more years. He's debating learning to be a rabbi. And he has no problem not listening to his parents. You, on the other hand, well, you're coming from the States, and you want to learn Torah. So you're thinking about going to yeshiva, but you're concerned with listening to your parents. I mean, doesn't this sound backwards? Right? So I said, well, here's the issue. The issue is, do you have an obligation to listen to your parents? Let's say that you decide you want to be a lawyer. You want to be a lawyer, you know, legitimate. So you have certain ethical problems as a Jew or as a human being to become a lawyer. Can you be a lawyer, I don't know, and not lie? Very difficult. Okay, so I'm sure you struggle with this ethical dilemma if you're a lawyer, but you decide you want to be a lawyer. So you tell your parents, you know, I'm really excited, I'm going to law school, got into Harvard Law School, whatever this. My son should be a lawyer. I want you should be a doctor. Do you have an obligation to listen to your parents? Keep it a vein. If your parents want you to be a doctor, you have to be a doctor. Let's get a little more serious. You meet a guy or a girl, and you bring them home to mommy and daddy, right? And you're all excited. And they say, we want for you a blonde girl, not a brunette. See, look at parents like, what's wrong with them? But that's what they want. They don't want you to marry this person. They want you to marry a different person. Now, sometimes they may be ridiculous. I don't know, the person comes from the wrong family. The person, you know, you should marry the child of someone with a lot of money. You should marry the child of someone who has no money because money spoils. Whatever their reasoning is. You know, you're 5'2", she's 6'9", not a good idea. Whatever you want, I don't know. All stereotypes. So, do you have to listen to them? What is kibbutz avim? What is respect for your parents? It's very important to define this. So I want to give you an idea, which I just think is important that we establish in terms of the definition of respecting your parents before we can go out and begin to discuss it. In other words, this is not really the essence of discussing this particular mitzvah, but I just feel it's important to clear the air and get a working definition. So there's an interesting verse. And it's a verse which is found in a place that seemingly has nothing to do with respecting your parents. And out of the blue comes this verse that screams parent-child relationship. And you wonder what it's doing there. So take a look at this verse. We were there yesterday. Not accidental. Look in Genesis. We're in chapter 2. And God has just decided that it's not good that man be alone. It's not good that man be alone. Yesterday we were talking about, this same chapter. I want to just point that as an aside. One of the reasons that you will always find people going back to this chapter, to the first couple of chapters of Genesis, is because this really, especially the first two, these are the introduction to the entire Torah. And the blueprint of the entire Torah is in here. And you can find all the time relationships between any topic in the Torah and these chapters. So not that any verse or any word or any letter in the Torah is less or more important than another, but there's an order to the Torah and there's a reason that there's an order to the Torah. So that's worth pointing out. Now look at this. So God creates woman, okay? And he creates woman from man because they essentially have to view themselves as having the potential to be as one. And there's an unbelievable Midrash. The Midrash says that when man was first created, you know, it doesn't make sense, right? Look at the verse, right? I pointed this out to you yesterday, but we didn't discuss it. Verse 18. Vayomer Hashem, God says, Lo tov heyot adam levado. This is verse 18 on the bottom of page 2, right? In the second chapter of Genesis. It's not good that man be alone. I'll make him an Ezer Connect, right? I'll make him a life partner, whatever that is. So the obvious question that gets asked is, well, what do you mean it's not good for man to be alone? How can it be not good? What, God didn't know that man was going to be alone? So I spoke to you, I gave you one perception, and I told you yesterday that it was important first for man to be alone, to appreciate being without woman, being without a life partner, and then it was important for him not to be alone so that he could learn to have, or to make, or to find a life partner, right? Okay. Give you a different perspective. Unbelievable Midrash. And if I could think of a Midrash which depicts for me the idea that the issue of Midrash, of rabbinic legend, is not whether it really was, but what I'm supposed to learn for it and what it means, this is a good example. Midrash says that man was originally created as an androgynous, as a two-sexed creature. He was a man, or he, she, or was a man and a woman. Now, I don't know what this means physically, because I don't think that's the issue. I don't know if it means like one side of him was man and one side of him was woman, or just he had everything physically, or everything emotionally, but that's what the Midrash says. And then, for whatever the reasons, it's a long Midrash, so God decides to split them up. That, you know, when you get married, you'll see. There are a lot of challenges when you get married. And one of them is to learn what not to give up on. Very important. It's very important when you get married to learn, and I think this is true in general relationships, to learn to compromise, to learn how to be able to be accepting and how to be giving and how you build each other. But it's also important to learn how to maintain your space, right? You're used to, for X number of years, living on your own, and you have your own space. And, you know, I don't know, wherever you live, in a college dorm room or in an apartment or whatever it is, so you wouldn't expect somebody to lie down with you in the same bed. And if somebody did it, no matter how close a friend they were, you'd be like, excuse me? And all of a sudden you get married and this person just sleeps in the same bed. It's a little strange. You know, you always pick up your laundry. You put it in a hamper. And then you get married to somebody who likes to play basketball with the laundry. And it's all over the room. How do you do that? So you have your space. It's very important. And that's very much in those ideas. So man is split back into two. And now there's man. Now it's interesting that if man is split into two, what happens to the other half? So that's another discussion. But now man is alone. What's the underlying theme of this Midrash? Is that for the rest of my life, I'm attempting to reestablish that original creative act. I was once one. And now I'm split. So love and all that it means to me is my attempt to reestablish that connection. This, by the way, is quite clearly an allegory for my relationship with God. Man is in the Garden of Eden, and he is at one with God. And then he blows it, and somehow he is split from God. And the rest of our existence is spent attempting to recapture that relationship, to recapture Eden, to return, to redevelop that closeness for God. And that's what love really is. My love for another human being is a reflection of my love for God. And it's an attempt to reestablish that connection. Okay. So now God creates woman. And woman comes from man, which obviously has a lot to do with this. And what that means and what the rib is and why man has to be asleep when woman is created and all of that, that's a discussion maybe if we ever give a course on relationships. But then comes this verse that makes no sense. Look in on the next page, chapter 2. Vayomer ha'adam. This is verse 23, right? Zot hapam. Now I know. Etzem me'atzamai. Bone of my bones. Uvasar mi'psari. Flesh of my flesh. Lezot yikare isha ki me'ish lukach hazot. And this shall be named woman because she was taken from man. In other words, the word isha and the word ish are almost the same word, because they're very much interconnected. And I'll point something out to you that I pointed out in the last course, but which I think so fits here that it's worth mentioning. If you look at the letters, right? If you look at the letters of the word ish and the word isha, so you'll see that the word ish has three letters, right? Aleph, yud, and shin. And the word isha also has three letters. Aleph, shin, and hey. And there are two letters which are common to both. And they are Aleph and Shin. Right? And then there are two letters which are uncommon to both. And they are the Yud and the Hey. And say the rabbis, if there is God involved in the partnership of man and woman, if between a man and a woman exists the presence of God, if God is brought into their relationship, and if it's not a partnership but a three-way triad, then they can become one. But if God is removed from the equation, then all that's left is Esh, fire, the fire of destruction. And it's very interesting that that's what these verses are saying. And within that context now, look at the next verse. Al kein, therefore, Ya'azov ish et aviv ve'et imo. Man shall leave his father and his mother, right? V'davak be'ishto, and he shall cling to his wife. V'hayu levasar echad, and they shall become as one flesh. In other words, that's my goal, to become somehow one. That's a very interesting verse. What does that verse mean? First of all, just as an aside, because I know that there are a lot of people who think of these issues when this section arises, it's interesting to note, people sometimes have a problem with this whole story. What do you mean? Man was created and then woman's just a rib, and man is naming woman, and what does that mean? And is woman subservient to man? Is that how I view this? When you look at the Torah, it appears, and again, this is my perspective, but it appears that that's not at all what the Torah is trying to imply. First of all, as I've mentioned before, obviously everything depends on your initial perspective. If this is a story that's written by gods, then the issue is not how could, but why? What does it mean? Right? If it's written by man, so then obviously it's chauvinistic and it's no problem because that's man. Man is subjective. You can't have an objective man. Right? But if it's written by God, I want to understand this. And so it's interesting that the creative process begins with God removing something from man, but that the process continues with man attempting to subjugate himself to woman. In other words, this verse essentially says that it's not woman who leaves for man, but man who leaves for woman. It's very interesting. And it's very interesting, by the way, and I've never figured this out because I've never really taken time to analyze this process. But I know now that, my brother and one of my brothers, and I have now three out of four brother-in-laws who are all married. And so I'm starting to get an opportunity to look at different familial group relationships. from people that I'm close enough to be able to appreciate them. And I notice a very interesting pattern. I don't know if this is really accurate or just happens to be in my particular family circumstance, but I notice that the woman, very often, the daughter, will very often set a certain tone. I don't know why that is. And there's a closeness between a woman and her parents that's brought into the home. The husband, very often, becomes a little distanced from his parents in his attempt to develop a relationship and to focus on the relationship with his wife and his wife's family. I don't know why that is. And I don't know if maybe I've just noticed this in the relationships that I've noticed, and maybe I'm, because this isn't scientific, but it's interesting. And people that I talk to, I've always tried to figure this out. I don't know, it's very interesting. But this verse seems to say that that's actually a goal. So now, how do I understand this in terms of my definition of Kibbud Av Ve'im? So says the Chatam Sofer of Moshe Sofer, one of the famous halachic authorities, in the 1800s in Germany, who I think I mentioned not so long ago, says the Chatam Sofer, and it's based actually on a Talmudic discussion in Kiddushin, in the Tractate of Kiddushin, says the Chatam, good call, says the Chatam Sofer, right? Halachically, you don't have an obligation to listen to your parents in a decision that reflects your life. In other words, if your parents come into the room, you have an obligation to give them food, to give them a chair, to take their coat, a biblical obligation. But if your parents come into a room and say, excuse me, but I think this should be redecorated, that affects your life, you don't have an obligation. Now, this is obviously a general definition, and it's very difficult. You have to get into details. Sometimes it's not so clear-cut. But that's the reason why I don't have to listen to my parents if they tell me to become a doctor. I don't have to listen to my parents if they tell me, we don't want you to do the army. I don't have to listen to my parents if they tell me, not to stay in Israel, or not to go to this university, or not to take a trip around the world, or whatever it might be. Now, I'm an idiot, don't get me wrong, if I don't try to learn from their advice. They have experience, they know me, and you should always listen to your parents. But whether you choose to agree with what they have to say and follow it, that's not a halachic question. That's a psychological, moral, ethical question beyond halach. And that depends on the given circumstance. So that's very important. It's very important to understand that that is the definition of Kibbud Av Ve'im. Okay? So we're not talking about this tremendous idea that my parents' advice is paramount. And that everything my parents tell me to do is the wisdom of sage. And that I have to listen to them. Now that's not always true. I have certain relationships in Judaism where I do have to listen to whatever they tell me. I'll give you an example. A melech, a king. If a king in Judaism comes and tells me, you have to be a doctor, then you have to be a doctor. Now whether a king would do that is another question. But you have to obey the king. If a king tells you that you now have to leave your family and go to war, you have to go to war. And if he tells you you can't go to the army, then you can't. Because that's the king. And it's very interesting, by the way, there's a discussion in the Talmud, because there's also a middle relationship. There's parent, there's king, there's a third one in which these issues apply. This question of obeying or disobeying, listening. What would that relationship be? Who would that relationship refer to? Your teacher. Right? If you have someone who's your teacher, and we'll define for the moment a teacher as someone who teaches you Torah, which of course is in and of itself very difficult to define. There's a famous story about the Chafetz Chaim. Chafetz Chaim was in a room at a conference. It was a conference of the great sages of the world, the Moetzet Gedolim. And he was the principal person involved. He was the, whatever they called it, the chairman or the president. And they met, I forget where it was, in Warsaw. And it was a huge gathering. There were hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of people there. And the greatest Torah sages of Chaim Ozer and the Chafetz Chaim and the Ger Rebbe and all these tremendous Torah sages were together. And they were dealing with very important issues, the issue of refugees after World War I and all sorts of major issues. And all of a sudden the Chafetz Chaim jumps up. He jumps up. And he runs around the table and starts running towards the back of the hall. Now, when the Chafetz Chaim stands up, I mean, there's a beautiful tradition. It's actually a halacha. That if your teacher walks into a room, if your Rebbe, whoever it is, walks into a room, You have to stand for them. Now, the halacha says, Jewish law technically says, you only do this twice a day. In other words, if I'm sitting in a Beit Midrash, and my, let's say my Rosh Hashiva, is just pacing back and forth, trying to figure out a thought, you know, so I don't have to go, you know, I mean, that's ridiculous. So twice a day, that's what it says. So, and this, by the way, applies to any teacher. I remember when Rav Lichtenstein lost his, I think it was his mother. So I went to the Shiva. You know, it was a Jewish tradition that for 7 days following the funeral, that the mourners sit on low chairs and they're in mourning, and they're not supposed to try to distract themselves in the mourning, but focus on it and deal with it, and you come and visit them, and there are all sorts of beautiful halachot that deal with these issues of mourning. And I went to Rav Lichtenstein Shiva, there's my Rebbe, and I had intended only to be there for a little bit, but it was such a learning experience, I ended up sitting there for like 4 hours. And it was like a who's who of great personalities in Yerushalayim. The chief rabbi of Yerushalayim came, the Rosh Chief of Karen B'Yavne, one of the great yeshivot came, all these different people came. Anyway, we were praying the evening service, and Nechama Leibovich walked in. Nechama Leibovich is, I could say, she is probably, if not the, certainly one of, probably the person most responsible for my knowledge of Chumash. And she's my really my Chumash Rebbe. She's an incredible, incredible lady. And I learned Chumash from a lot of different people, but she really had a profound influence on me. She wrote a set of volumes called, they're translated into English, Studies in Genesis, Studies in Exodus, etc. There's a couple of volumes of them back there if you're curious. Brilliant, brilliant stuff. You want to learn how to learn Chumash? If you take the time to go through these volumes, you will learn how to learn Chumash. Just from studying this 6-volume set. It's a magnificent, magnificent set. Anyway, she came, and we were in the middle of the evening service. And you know, the men were in one room, and the women were off on the side in another room. And Rav Lichtenstein's wife, Professor Lichtenstein, saw Nechama Leibovich in the back. Without any hesitation, she grabs a chair, walks through the room, middle of Maariv, walks through the room, puts the chair that Nechama Leibovich shouldn't have to stand. You know, she's an older lady. She was at the time probably 78, 77. Anyway, when Maariv was over and everybody was sitting down, so she walked in. So, when people saw her walk in, everybody stood up. Because she's a Torah scholar. Rav Lichtenstein's father, who was sitting shiva, started to stand up. And Rav Lichtenstein grabbed his shoulder and said, no, you don't have to stand. There's a halacha that a mourner doesn't stand for their teacher because he's mourning. And Rav Lichtenstein's father said, Ani lo yachol. Right? I can't not stand up for Nechama Leibovich. Which, of course, is probably why Rav Lichtenstein became Rav Lichtenstein. So, there's an obligation. Now, this teacher, okay, has the same issue. When do I listen to my teacher? When do I not listen to my teacher? It's a very interesting question. So the Talmud says that there are three instances. Well, the Talmud asks an interesting question. The Talmud says, what if such a person of this relationship foregoes their honor? My father says, I don't know, listen, you know what? Call me Paul. Call my father Paul, I call my father Abba. Right? Can he say, call me Paul? Can I tell my children, call me Bini? Putting aside the educational issue, whether I would ever do that. But let's say he doesn't. I know families that do that. I happen to have a problem with it personally. Maybe that's just a perspective, but okay. But let's say he does it, can he do it? Let's say my Rebbe says to me, you know, Rav Riskin, call me Shlomo. Let's say the king, right? King Solomon says, call me Shlomo. Can I do it? Talmud, very interesting. Talmud says that with a Rebbe and a parent, mochlin al kvodom, if they forego their honor, kvodom machul, then their honor is forgotten. Right? If I'm walking, and this is something that happens all the time, if I'm walking out the door with my teacher, and I hold the door open for my teacher, which is an obligation, so my teacher can say, no, come on. And that's it. And you don't have to play this stupid game. And they can walk through. If the king does it, you can't do it. Even if the king, you stand there for 20 minutes. King goes first. You cannot call King Shlomo, Shlomo, if that's part of the issue. And you can't remain seated when he walks in the room. You can't. That's it. Right? Very interesting to equate and figure out what this difference is. Essentially, my honor. Okay? Well, you know what? Let's leave that as a question. So what is that? How does that work? Okay? Right? Why is the king different from a parent and a teacher? So now let's go a stage further. Now we've got a few good questions. And we've started to look at the issue of Kibbud Av V'Em. But of course we're not there yet. Why are we not there yet? What do we still have to do?
The other half.
Okay, let's do a little more learning. Look now at the issue of Kibbud Av V'Em. verse 16. Tell me what you see. What bothers you?
He's saying, as the Lord God.
Okay, that is the only addition that you will find in all the commandments here in the second section, which makes sense. Now, it's not an easy idea, Kasher Tzivcha Hashem Elokecha, that God has commanded you. But let's, if you remember what we said yesterday, we said that this second set of commandments was said by Moshe just before he dies, and the Jews enter the land of Israel, to the second generation. And it's part of their ethical message that they're receiving before they go into the land of Israel, because they weren't at Sinai. So now I understand that Moshe is telling them this is what God has commanded. It's still a difficult question, because why does he have to repeat it for each commandment? Let's put it in a nutshell and just say that that each commandment is unique and each commandment is special and whatever. It happens to be a very good question, don't get me wrong, right? But we'll put it aside, because it'll get us into another topic, and I want to... Yes, Angie, you want to say something? Oh. Does everybody see that? There's an extra phrase here. The original commandment is Leman Yarichun Yamecha Al Adama Asher Hashem Elokecha Noten Lach, that you will have lengthy days on the land that God gives you. Here, all of a sudden, I got something extra. Leman Yitavlach. What does the word Yitav mean? Where does it come from? You want to understand what a reward is and why this reward is here, what it means. We want to understand what the reward itself is, what Ha'arachat Yamim means. And now we also want to understand what Leman Yitavlach, what that it will be good for you means. How does this work? So let's work backwards. Okay? What this second set of commandments is telling you, that if you fulfill this commandment, it will be good for you. What is good? Let's accept for the moment that from my perspective, the traditional perspective, so my definition of good and evil is that what God says is good, and what God says is evil is evil. I'm willing to buy that. In fact, who was I discussing that with yesterday? With Jesse, right? We were talking about this, that this may well be the biggest problem for an atheist. Because if there is no higher authority, and there is no objective authority, then by definition, good and evil are subjective. Now that's not any kind of a proof or anything, because an atheist can be willing to say, well, fine, so good and evil are subjective. But it's an issue because the average person doesn't want to say that good and evil are subjective. But okay. But if that's true, then my definition of good and evil is that what God says is good, and what evil is evil, fine. Notwithstanding that definition, so what is good? We know that there's one thing which defines not goodness. Not goodness is alone. Loneliness is not goodness. That's a very strange phrase, by the way. In fact, I had a whole theory, and it was a great theory. I got it from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, so I figured it was a great theory, right? You have to learn how easy it is to listen to someone else's words and go one stage further and be sure you're right. So I had a great theory, right? So I told you that God creates the world through words. Words are somehow a reflection of reality, and therefore, if you want to see things that are illusions, look for words that don't appear in the Torah. I mentioned to you a few of them, right? Safek, doubt doesn't appear in the Torah. It's not real. It's an illusion. It's from us. It's not from God. Fine. What is good and what is evil? So the Rebbe says at a certain point, he was once giving a speech and he said, what is evil? Evil is an illusion. Evil really is the absence of good. Evil is the absence of good. Evil isn't a substance. It's the absence of good. And good illuminates the world and throws away the darkness, which is evil. And I thought, oh, this is great. Let's think about this. And it's very interesting, by the way. There's a machloket, there's a debate. It's one of those debates that the rabbis have when they're sort of really relaxed. It's a debate between the Ramban and the Vilna Gaon. The Ramban lived in the 13th century, the Vilna Gaon lived in the 18th century. But, you know, two such people can have a debate in Torah. It doesn't matter that they live 400 years apart, right? Never met anybody, because they did. So God says, it's interesting. It says, Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim v'et ha'aretz. God created the heavens and the earth, right? The aretz hayta tohu vavohu, and the land was all chaos and confusion. V'choshech al panei tahom, and there was darkness on the deep, whatever that means, right? Everybody realizes I'm saying the words, I'm trying to translate them, but we don't know what they mean, but okay. And there was darkness, because what's the deep, and what's the darkness, and what's God, and what's land, and what's sky? Okay. But there was darkness, right? V'choshech al panei tahom. V'ruach Elokim rachefet al panei hamayim, and the wind of God is like hovering over the water, whatever that means, right? God says, let there be light. God says the light is good. So the first time I see good is light. That's why the Rebbe is saying that, right? And God then separates the or, light, and the choshech, darkness. So now you got a very interesting question. It doesn't say that God created darkness. It just says that God created light. So is darkness a separate creation? And there are two opinions. Because there's always going to be two opinions in Judaism. So there's two opinions. So the Ramban, if I'm not getting them mixed up, Rav Moshe ben Nachman says, no, darkness is not a separate creation. Darkness is merely the absence of light. And the Vilna Gaon says, no, darkness is a separate creation. Darkness is darkness and light is light. Now the Vilna Gaon, it's interesting, may well have understood the scientific principle. We now know that you can create darkness. Because if I aim two lasers, at least in theory, they haven't been able to do this scientifically, but if I take two lasers and I aim their beams perfectly, in perfect congruence, one at the other, so the photons, the particles of energy, will destroy each other, and I will have a created darkness, which somehow scientifically is a darkness of a different substance. Now what that means, I don't know. Right? Ask Carl Sagan. Well, you can't ask him anymore, but whatever, right? So, whatever. Oliver Shalom. So, okay. So, what are they really arguing about? What does this really mean? So, light represents good. And darkness represents evil. And the Ramban is saying, no slouch the Ramban, that darkness is the absence of good. Evil is merely the absence of good. And the Vilna Gaon is saying, no, you can have a substance evil. Don't just assume that evil is the absence of good. When Hasidut arose as a movement, it was all about light. And Hasidut came into the Jewish world at one of the darkest periods in Jewish history. It had not been that long since Shabtai Tzvi, a false messiah, had converted to Islam and taken thousands of Jews with him. Hundreds of thousands of Jews who had believed that the messiah had finally come were thrown into the throes of despair. And many of the great rabbinic authorities at the rise of Hasidut saw the danger of another potential false messianic movement, and therefore they were vehemently opposed, because the Hasidim said, we're getting too stuck on text. We're getting too stuck on removing darkness. We have to be focused on making light. And so they said, never mind what you say when you daven, when you pray. Just dance. Just sing it, even if you don't know it. And never mind studying the Talmudic tractate. Just open up your heart to God. So you can imagine how people who are steeped in text and textual study and halachic minute, they would be very nervous about such an approach. So they vehemently opposed it. Now it's interesting, this is my opinion, that the opposition, especially the opposition of the Vilna Gaon, who was undoubtedly the greatest sage of his generation, was probably very important for Hasidut, because it tempered Hasidut to a certain stage, extent, and it may well have been the reason that Hasidut joined mainstream Judaism, as opposed to going off into some messianic movement. So this was very important, and it's funny that today some of the students of the Vilna Gaon and the great Mitnagdim who were originally against Hasidut are now Hasidim. And some of the greatest Hasidic masters are steeped in Torah study and Talmud and everything else, and they've become students of those originals, so now it's a mishmash, Baruch Hashem. Right? But it's interesting that the Vilna Gaon was the one who made this statement about darkness. Because there's a very interesting phrase. It's a verse. Sur Meira, turn away from evil, va'aseh tov, and do good. So there's a big debate, what does this mean? So, the Misnagdim, those who were against Hasidut, probably as a part of their philosophy, very often viewed this phrase as very important. Sur Meira, turn away from evil. How do you get rid of evil? You got to turn away from it. You have to focus on not being involved in evil, on not being distracted, on removing yourself from all possibility of evil. And everything that is evil and everything that is negative and everything that can distract you from the true path, you have to avoid it.
So throw yourself into a Beit Midrash and focus on your learning. And if you walk down the street, don't look at anything, not women, not advertisements, nothing. And make sure that all the music is Jewish music and you shouldn't listen to other because of the environment and what it'll do. And never mind that you shouldn't eat unkosher food, but you shouldn't even go into an unkosher food store. And you shouldn't walk on the street with an unkosher food store. And you shouldn't live in the neighborhood with an unkosher food store. And just make sure that unkosher food is across the sea. And let's make sure we stay away from evil. And you don't want to speak slander. So better not to sit at the table with anybody than to risk speaking slander. And just focus yourself. Make sure. Don't get involved in evil. Be involved. Chazer said, no. What are you so worried about turning away from evil? Just do good. Asay tov. If you, asay tov, if you do good, the evil will take care of itself. That's this debate. So, evil, good, light, darkness. So evil is really an illusion, says the Hasidic Rebbe, and I had this great idea. I said, if evil is an illusion, it's not in the Torah. Good is the illumination, which makes me realize that evil is an illusion, but of course it doesn't work. It doesn't work because I find ra in the Torah, in numerous occasions. And then I had a theory, well, okay, so maybe ra, right, is always, which means evil, is always from me. Maybe wherever I would find ra in the Torah, it would be for man. That man shouldn't do evil. So I could still say that even though there is evil, evil always still stems from man. And anything which stems from man is partially an illusion. Notwithstanding the fact that that didn't work because the word is in the Torah and the Torah is from God. It still didn't work because I find instances, for example, in Deuteronomy 28, where it says that God gives an evil affliction and that's not from man, even though it affects man and it's because man acts, whatever. So at a certain point I said, stop trying to clutch at straws, it doesn't work, fine. So how does that, can we react to this? What is good? What does it mean, l'man yitavlach? So I want to give you a theory. And I think that this theory is the essence of this entire question. And it also explains to me, by the way, why this commandment is so crucial. And it's here in the Ten Commandments. And why it comes here on the side of my relationship with God. And why there's a difference between the two commandments. And I want to just point you out, I'm going to give you maybe a 5-minute break so you can think about this. But I just want to point out to you, when you discover something that's beautiful, so hang on to it, it's a good thing. When you discover something that's beautiful in Torah, if you have a question, something bothers you, and you're searching, and now you're really learning because something bothers you, and that's wonderful. Sometimes you come up with an idea, comes up with an answer that works. So you say, well, who am I? Maybe this doesn't work. So there's two approaches. And these are legitimate approaches within Torah study, within traditional Torah study. You can find this in different authoritative works on how to study Torah. There are two approaches to how to arrive at conclusions, at closure, at perspectives, if not answers, to the questions that bother you in Torah. One is, okay, look it up. Look it up. If you have an idea, well, see if anybody says it. Okay, so maybe Rashi says it, maybe the Ramban says it, maybe the Rambam says it, maybe it's mentioned in the Talmud, etc. And that's obviously a very difficult approach, because you have to know where to look. But in one way, it's very easy. You don't have to test your theory. All you have to do is find somebody who says it. Okay. There's a different approach. And I obviously don't believe that these two approaches are exclusive of each other. Rather, they're a synthesis one of the other. Second approach is test your theory on different questions. If you have something that bothers you in Torah, and you have a perspective, if that perspective resolves all of your conclusions, making individual questions and answers into an organic whole, changing a thread into a tapestry, then you know that you usually have the right idea. So if I have all these different questions on Kibbutz Av Ein, and I can come up with one idea that connects them all together, and if I then test that idea, or you test that idea, and you find that any other question you come up with regards to Kibbutz Av Ein is resolved, or at least takes a different direction with this perception, then that tells you that perception is probably real. And that's a whole different way of learning. And on the one hand, it's more difficult, because it involves much more creativity. On the other hand, it's easier because you don't have to know where to look. You just have to look within yourself. And that's really the essence of Torah, is to find the Torah that's already within you. Okay. So I want to see if we can come up with an idea like that. So I'll give you one perspective, but it's my perspective. And you may not like it, or you may disagree with it, or it may bother you, or whatever it may be. So your challenge is to find why it doesn't work for you, and then see if you can come up with one that does work for you, and then you're learning Torah. So what's going on? And just to summarize where we're at. What is respecting your parents? Beyond our definition. Why is it in the Ten Commandments? Why is it that there's a reward for respecting your parents specifically? Why is it that in Deuteronomy, the reward is a little different? And I add, leman yitavlach, in order that it be good for you. And what are these rewards? How do I understand them? And why is all of this part of Bein Adam L'Makom, of my relationship to God? So let's see. What's the yesod of Kibud Avein? What am I doing when I respect my parents? Why do I have to respect my parents? Think about it. If a dog passes me by in the street and doesn't bite me, so I should be filled with gratitude that this dog didn't bite me, if I take the time to appreciate that it could have bit me. And yet I have no obligation to honor my dog. So it can't be that honoring parents is merely a result of the fact that they could have done things differently. What is honoring your parents? Honoring your parents is the act of appreciation par excellence. In order to appreciate what your parents really did for you, you have to become a parent yourself. And even when you're a parent yourself, your parents are still your parents. So that in order to appreciate your parents as your parents, when you're already a parent, you really have to become a grandparent. And when you're a grandparent, if you're lucky, your parents are still your parents. So that to appreciate everything your parents do for you, when you're a grandparent, you have to become a great-grandparent. And of course, by the time you become a great-grandparent, your parents aren't there anymore. Which means that you have to be willing to appreciate something that you can't really appreciate. There's a certain act, an essence of faith within the appreciation that I have for my parents. Right? I now have 3 children. And everybody has their different stages in becoming a parent. For me, 3 was most difficult. You know, when you have 1 child, they say you're not a real parent because when something breaks, nobody knows who did it. When you have 2 children, so they say you're not a real parent because you still have a hand for each child. When you have a 3rd child, so all of a sudden, you know, you don't have it's overwhelming. Now, I'm 1 of 3 children. So as a parent, I've now reached the stage that my parents reached. And it's incredible to me when I consider how much goes into each of my children. I mean, I've been this year, like, overcompensating almost for everything, you know, for having an infant. Because the kids get up in the morning and they have their routine. And Adi, the infant, so she has her routine. And Baruch Hashem, you know, when I was first married, so I thought I'm going to be super dad. I am going to be super dad. I mean, it began from, you know, the beginning of conception. I went out and got all the books, you know, when my wife was pregnant with our first, with Mayan. I read through the Columbia Book of Medicine. I knew all the symptoms. I remember even once a friend of my wife's, Judy Sturman, called up and she had something and she wasn't sure what it was. So Dorit asked me, I said, oh, it's probably Braxton Hicks. And later after the doctor said, I just got really into this, you know? And we played classical music while the children were in the womb because they developed their hearing at a certain age. And I said to my wife, okay, you know, don't speak. Shh, you know, the child's going to hear you. You know, my sometimes Dorit looked at me like, okay, right? I got really into this. And when the baby was born, I thought, I'm going to be super dad. It took about 2 weeks. I would wake up, you know, the baby would cry, and I would jump out of bed. I wanted the baby next to my bed, you know, next to my side of the bed, right? And I feel, I'll get up, and I'll bring up the baby, and I'll be there with my wife, you know, and I'll help her, you know, nurse, whatever. Nope, biologically, there are certain limitations. So after about 2 weeks, and we're both walking around the next day like zombies, we realized, okay, this isn't working. This is just stupid, right? I get up at 2 in the morning, get the baby up, bring the baby over to my wife, stand there like an idiot until she's finished, bring the baby back, right? this happens again at 3 and at 4 and at 5 because my kids were not easy kids, nursing, whatever. So after a couple of weeks, I say, okay, bad idea. Somebody's got to be awake in the morning, right? So when I think about how much, as parents, we do for our children, everything that goes into them, so now I'm getting an inkling of what it means to appreciate my parents. But the obligation of appreciating my parents began when I was 13 years old, from a halachic perspective. So how could I possibly fulfill this mitzvah at 13 as I do now? And my parents, Baruch Hashem, my parents, my wife's parents, they're wonderful grandparents. And they do a lot for us as parents still. And as old as you are, you know, I remember a story I read about Rav Tursky. Rav Tursky, very, very special individual, lives in Efrat on my block half the year. And he's written a number of books. He was slated to be the next Bubba Rebbe. His father was a great Hasidic Rebbe. He comes from a long dynasty. But he decided at a very early age that he realized that people were taking their problems not to the Rebbe, but to psychiatrists. So he became a psychiatrist. He went to med school, did the whole thing, which was unheard of in his day. And he opened up actually a chemical dependency center in Pittsburgh. It's called Gateway. And has done magnificent, magnificent work, helping people, Jews and non-Jews, with chemical dependency problems. Matter of fact, his name is Shia Tursky. So they call his followers, who become very devoted to him, Shiites. Because, anyway, so yeah, you know, the Shiites are moving into town. It's an interesting until you explain it. Anyway, he relates an unbelievable story. He was giving a lecture, I don't know where it was, Montreal or Toronto or somewhere. And it was like one of these Sunday morning, right after Minyan lecture, brunches, whatever. And he noticed that there was this quite elderly gentleman who came to Minyan, who came to the prayer service, who was very involved in the prayer service, and who was sitting at the front of the lecture, and who was really enthusiastic. You know, sometimes a student gets a look on their face and you know they're really into it. And he thought, wow, look at this guy. This guy's obviously, you know, quite elderly, and he's here, he's at Minyan, he's coming to lecture, it's great. So he went over to meet the guy, and he was talking to him, and the guy was saying how inspiring he was, you know. And of course, he was saying, well, you know, I find it very inspiring myself, you know, to be teaching someone of your age, whatever. You know, you always got to be careful with that. But over 80, you can say that. You know, between like 35 and 70, you got to be careful. Over like 70, definitely. And this guy was 87 years old, or 84 years old, I don't remember, right? So he says, you know what? You got to meet my dad. Meet my dad? He says, yeah. So I want to take you to meet my dad. You got an 84, 87-year-old sitting in your audience. He says he's going to meet your dad. So anyway, he took him to meet his dad. His dad was in a nursing home. He was 104 or 107 years old. 104 years old, gewalt. Right? He said the most amazing thing about it was that when they walked in, right? So, you know, he was sitting and the father turned to the son, to this 87-year-old, 84-year-old, and says to him, no, you don't get a chair for the rabbi, sonny. You're always a father. And you're always a son. Always. So, what is Kibud Av V'Em? Kibud Av V'Em reflects one of the most essential ideas in Judaism. The concept of Hakarat HaTov. Of being able to appreciate and recognize good. The entire story of humanity begins with this issue. When God gives Adam and Eve the opportunity to fulfill their first mitzvah, and they blow it, they eat from the tree. If you look at the verses carefully in the third chapter of Genesis, it's very clear they don't blow it by eating from the tree. That's not what happens. Because if they'd blown it by eating from the tree, then God would have come to man and woman and said, listen, you ate from the tree, goodbye, out of here, right? No more Garden of Eden. Everybody out of the pool. That's what he would have said. That's not what God says. God comes into the Garden of Eden, right? He's walking through the garden, and man and woman, you know, they're putting on these fig leaves, and God says, Ayeka. It's one of the strangest questions ever asked. Where are you? So what that means, again, has to relates to the question that God asks Cain, where is your brother? And to understand that connection, you have to understand a few more questions, so we won't get to it, but if you hear the next course, you'll figure it out. However, Adam then has this whole dialogue with God. And what does Adam say? Adam says, Ha'isha asher natata imadi, he hisiyani va'ochel. He says, the woman you gave me, she made me eat it. God sees that man is alone. It's not good. He makes for him a woman. What does man do? Huh, what do you want from me? You gave it to me. The rabbis say that's the reason man has to leave the Garden of Eden. Because you can't be in the Garden of Eden if you don't appreciate the Garden of Eden. Now I want to tell you, appreciating what we have is a very, very difficult thing. A very difficult thing. A tremendous challenge. And you find this in every aspect of life. The real challenge, if you discover a relationship with Shabbat, is not that you come to Israelite and you have a great Shabbos. It's not that you leave note and it's unbelievable. It's not that you go to Shlomo Kalbach Synagogue and you have this amazing service. It's, can you do that every week? Can you get used to being in the Garden of Eden and at the same time appreciate it? And that's where man blows it. Man looks at the world and he doesn't recognize it as good. He doesn't appreciate it. And if you don't appreciate what you have as good, you don't deserve it. The next major boo-boo in history is Cain. And what does Cain do? Cain decides he's going to offer up a sacrifice to God. And Abel, his brother, does the same thing. He offers up a sacrifice to God. Except that for some reason, God, Vayisha Hashem el Hevel vel minchatel, he sort of leans over in favor of Abel's sacrifice. V'el Cain vel minchatel lo sha'a. And he didn't favor Cain's sacrifice. And then Cain is upset and he's jealous and he gets into an argument with Abel and he kills Abel. So if you look at it, whose fault is it? I mean, if I come into class every day and I give one student, right, an apple and a good chair and I make them coffee and everything else, and everybody in the class starts to resent that student, they get into a big fight, whose fault is that? It's my fault. In fact, if you look at it, the whole story of Joseph is not Joseph's fault, it's Jacob's fault. How can he give Joseph the technicolor coat? So God messed up, the ultimate educator. What's the problem? Where does it begin? It begins with Abel and Cain's sacrifices. Because it says that Abel's sacrifice, Vayaveh Hevel, Mibchorot Tzono Michalvehen. Abel brought from the best of his flock. Abel says to himself, you know what? I'm a shepherd. And I have all of these, I mean, he had all the sheep in the world. There was no competition. You know, talk about a good business opportunity. In fact, it's really incredible when you think about the fact that Abel and Cain got into an argument. Abel was a farmer, and Cain was a shepherd. They should have had nothing to argue about. But put two people in a room and they'll find something to argue about. That's the way it is. And they get into an argument, and Abel, they essentially split up the world. That's what the Medrash says. And Abel had all the land, right? Cain had all the land. He was the farmer. And Abel had all the property. He was the shepherd. So Cain says to Abel, get off my land. Fly. You have my land. Get off. Because the whole world was his. So Abel says to him, well, you're wearing my clothes. Take it off. In other words, it was a debate that wasn't based on logic. And where did it begin? When Cain brings his sacrifice, it says, Vayaveh Cain mipri adama. He brought vegetables. It's interesting that on the scale of appreciation, you know, there are different blessings. And each blessing signifies a different level. For example, you may have noted already that when I eat bread, I make a blessing. Hamotzi lechem min haaretz. And that blessing includes everything else. If I'm at a meal and I have bread and I make a blessing on the bread, it's a great clue for somebody who wants to start saying blessings, but they're nervous about remembering all the blessings. But you want to get into a habit of saying blessings. So just eat bread with every meal. It's not good for your diet, but just eat bread with every meal. Because if you eat bread with the meal, you don't make any other blessings on all the other things. If you don't eat bread, so you make a blessing on the fruit, you make a blessing on the vegetables, you make a blessing on the cake, then you got to start to wonder which one do you make first. And there's a whole halachic system. If I have cake and vegetables and fruit on my plate, first I go with the cake, because that's like a higher level somehow. And then I go with the fruit, because that's a higher level, and then I go with the vegetables. And the worst is something I make a shahakola, like water, or Coca-Cola, which I can understand, or whatever it might be, right? So what is this? What is this, like vegetables and fruit? Like fruit are better than vegetables? What does that mean? So the mystics have a beautiful perception. They say, what is a bracha? What's a blessing? A blessing, in essence, is my appreciation of what I have. Right? I have food. And I stop to realize before I eat this food, where I got it from, what it means to have it, and how lucky I am to appreciate it. We go through our days and we take it for granted. Take it for granted that we have food on our plate. There are places in the world that don't take that for granted. And we have an obligation to appreciate how lucky we are. Now maybe we're not on a level where we can have a silent meditation before every bite of our candy bar and think of Rwanda and of Ethiopia and of Afghanistan. But that's really what we should be doing. So at the very least, we say a blessing. And when I say the blessing, I say, thank you for giving this to me. I appreciate the fact that I have it. Now that appreciation has different levels. To appreciate a vegetable that comes right out of the ground, and I work the ground. And when I work the ground, the vegetable comes out of that ground. So the relationship with God is very clear. The rain comes, it goes into the ground, and the vegetable comes out. A tree, well, it's a little more difficult. Because the tree grows out of the ground. It's a little less connected to God. And it's a little harder to remember, somehow, allegorically, that it comes from the ground, and that ground gives forth fruit and bounty because of the rain. In other words, it's one step removed. Cake. Well, cake is even more removed because I have to knead it and I have to bake it, whatever else it might be. And bread, for various reasons that I won't go into, is even more removed. So essentially, the challenge of given blessings is my appreciation. So Cain, he doesn't even bring fruit. He brings vegetables, which are the rawest form. And it doesn't say that he brings the best vegetables. It just says he brings vegetables. So tradition tells us the reason that God had a problem with Cain's sacrifice was because Cain didn't appreciate what he had. Now, God didn't need Cain's appreciation, but Cain needed Cain's appreciation. And God gave Cain an opportunity. He didn't somehow favor his sacrifice. He was giving him a message. He was saying to him, there's something wrong. Here's an alarm bell. It's not working. You are not appreciating the way you should. What you have isn't really yours. It's given to you. And it has a purpose. And if you want it to be yours, you have to fulfill that purpose. And part of that purpose is to appreciate the world. Ultimate example of that is my relationship with my parents. Why is my relationship with my parents, beyond just being an act of appreciation, why is it in the list of commandments that relate to my relationship with God? Because my parents are partners with God in my creation. And everything I am, and everything that I can be, is a function of that partnership. And it's interesting that the Talmud, and you find this in Kabbalah and the mystics, says that the most apparent partnership that humanity has with God is in the creation of life. Because human beings are given the role of creating the physical part of humanity, and God retains the role of creating the spiritual part of humanity. And it's very interesting, even today, as much as we've progressed, science can explain down to the size of a single sperm how we as human beings were created, how the physical part of us came into being. But science can't explain the why. The spirit part of us, the part of us that is there with the physical and is gone when the physical ceases to function. That partnership, as apparent as it is to all of us, as obvious as it is in terms of the balance of my mind and my matter, the spiritual essence within and the physical essence without, as much as that partnership is evident, it's not something I can make tangible. And therefore, the partnership that my parents have with God is very much in evidence. And you discover this as parents. You know, everything you do in your life, you can prepare for. Everything. You can train for, you can prepare for, even marriage. You can think about. When it comes to children, how do you prepare for having children? How do you learn how to be a parent? I want to tell you the most awesome and yet the most incredible and yet the most frightening part of being a parent. Everything that you mess up on in your life, you can fix. You can undo, you can do again. Even marriage. You know, there's a mitzvah to get a divorce. If you decide that the marriage isn't right, and if the reasons are correct, and if halachically you're doing it, Jewish divorce, a get, is one of the mitzvot in the Torah. It would be fair to say that you should wake up every morning and pray not to fulfill all the mitzvot. But the fact is that if you have to get a divorce, so you can fulfill it with a mitzvah. You have an opportunity to fulfill a mitzvah. Even a divorce can be a productive experience. Even divorce can be right. What a gift it is that we, you know, everybody looks at the generations, right? And says, look where we are today. Today, 50% of people get divorced. And it's terrible. And people get divorced and it's negative and whatever. It's not so true. And people bandy about these statistics and it always bothers me. It bothers me even more because someone close to me got divorced. And my brother got divorced. And you know, I remember when he told me that, you know, he got married very young. And I remember my initial reaction was, look, you know, take it slow. I was here, he was there. Get counseling, be sure. I went to America that summer and we had long discussions. And at a certain point I said, you know what, you're right. You gotta get out of this. You gotta get out. What a bracha that we live in a generation where divorce is not this mark of Cain. Where people understand that divorce is a mitzvah. And that sometimes divorce is a gift. It doesn't mean that I marry a couple under the chuppah and I say, listen, I want you to know divorce is a gift. No, I don't talk about that under the chuppah. But you understand. It's a mitzvah. You can undo. You make a mistake. You marry the wrong person. Okay. You can learn tremendous things from it. Maybe the whole experience. I know a guy, wonderful, wonderful fellow, who I met a couple in Camp Moshavah where I was teaching. And when my brother was going all through this, he was tremendously valuable because he had been divorced very young. And after a few years, he got married. And I never knew this. You know, he didn't bandy it about. And he was married. He had like 6 children and a wonderful family. And I remember we were sitting and he was talking to my brother. We got into a conversation and he said, actually, you know, I'd love to talk to your brother. And I found that he was divorced. He said it was the most incredible experience, the whole thing. The most incredible experience. Because from this divorce, I learned how to be a good husband. I would not be the husband that I am today if I hadn't met this woman, married her, messed up, got divorced, and learned from the experience. I had a car accident. What a gift. What a wonderful experience. So I didn't enjoy lying in the hospital, but I learned from it. You can undo, you can recorrect, you can learn. But children, not so easy. You mess up on your child's childhood. How do you undo that? You can't give them another childhood. And even if you can make it better, even if you can realize and you can work on it, etc. You know, I had a horrible, horrible story. When I was learning to be a teacher, they took us for a day. And it was a very... it was an eye-opening experience, and it was quite innovative in its day, because this is, 10 years ago. And in Israel, this was not acceptable then, but Baruch Hashem, there was someone involved who recognized the value of this. We did a seminar on child abuse. We did a whole day on child abuse, a very practical day. How do you recognize that a child may be undergoing child abuse? And what do you do about it? And what do you not do about it? And the whole purpose of the day was not to give us all the answers, but to make us aware of the questions. And I became very intrigued and involved, and it occupied a lot of my thoughts. And I did a lot of reading on the subject, whatever. Anyway, when I first started teaching, I decided I would try every different type of teaching I could find until I found what I really enjoyed. Because if you're meant to be teaching adults like yourselves, then you're not meant to be teaching first graders. And if you're meant to be teaching first graders, so it means you're probably not meant to be teaching adults. So I wanted to try everything. I taught first grade for a year. It was a harrowing experience. It was wonderful. I learned a lot from it. I met my wife that year. It was a lot of fun. And you can imagine, I came to school with puppets and guitars and whatever. And I learned by the end of the year, as much as I loved it, that I was not meant to be a first grade teacher. And I still get students. Recently, I was at a wedding, and this girl comes over to me, and she's like, I don't know, 15, whatever. She says, oh, remember me? I was one of your students. And I was yeah, sure, I remember you. Right? Wonderful, right? And I remember there was a guy, and he came into class, and he kept having accidents. He kept coming late to class, and after a while, you know, he was always sluggish in the morning, and he was always bothered, and he would hit other kids, and it was negative. We finally figured out, you know, I went to somebody with a lot more experience than I do, finally figured out that the kid never got breakfast at home. Never got breakfast at home. His parents just didn't give him breakfast. So I tried talking to his parents, whatever. I realized after a while it wouldn't work, so we decided amongst us, you know, myself and the other teacher who was teaching the class, that we would give the kid breakfast. So we figured out a way to give him breakfast every day. So that made a little difference. Anyway, the kid, you know, he fell down the stairs 1 week. And 1 week he hurt his finger. And there was always, and it started to bother me. And then I remembered this seminar and I went to the principal. Turned out this kid was being beaten by his dad. Horrible experience. And I got very involved. And, you know, it was an experience that taught me a lot. I learned after this, you know, you have to know when to get involved and when not to get involved. Turned out eventually his dad had been beaten by his dad. And I'm willing to bet that his grandfather had been beaten by his dad. Someone started a process. You know how much work it takes to undo a process like that? If you mess up with your children, your children will mess up with their children. I mean, I look at my faults, my wife's faults, and I realize that they're a product of my parents' faults, and that's normal. And it's a real challenge to break such a process. And at the same time, the good that I am, whatever in me I can give, I learned from my parents. Because that was the paradigm, that was the first. And it's very interesting, by the way. What is the only other mitzvah in the Torah that I find that I'm given a reward? It's a very strange mitzvah. It's so mundane as to be ridiculous. It's called Shiloach HaKan. Ki Yikarei Kan Tzipor Lefanecha. If you come across a bird's nest, I actually once was able to fulfill this mitzvah. If you're in Camp Moshavah in the summer. If you come across a bird's nest and you want the eggs, you have to want the eggs. You have to be willing to use the eggs. Right? Not just. Before you take the eggs, you have to send away the mother bird. And if you fulfill this mitzvah, says the Torah, right? Why should you do this? L'man yarechun yamecha, l'man yitavlach v'arach tayamin. In order that it should be good for you, in order you should have long days. Same reward. What does birds and eggs have to do with parents? Same thing. You see, the bird will always come back to its nest. And the tradition says that one of the things that you're attempting to do is to show respect for that nest. The world was created so that we could benefit from the world. And it's legitimate to say that if there's a celery stalk, I can eat that celery. What gives me the right to eat that celery? God created it. God created me. I can eat eggs. But when I eat those eggs, I should appreciate where those eggs come from. They came from a mother bird. Now, the relationship between a mother and her children in the bird world is a relationship of instinct. And when the mother bird comes back later and the eggs aren't there, apparently, sociologically, anthropologically, whatever that means, the mother bird doesn't have the distress that we would have if we lost our children, God forbid. But the fact is that if the mother is there and the eggs are being taken away, then the mother's instinct causes it to have distress. They did a fascinating experiment. They discovered that they used like six different examples, but in instances like this, the mother would not go back to the nest afterwards. If you take eggs away from a mother, or chicklings away from a mother, when the mother is there, the bird will build a new nest. That nest is now destroyed for it. It's nifka. The bird can't live in that nest now, because that's the nest where the children were taken away. In other words, what I'm having respect for is that bird's nest, its home, its base. I'm appreciating what the eggs are. I'm appreciating where they come from. And that's exactly what I'm doing with my parents. And this appreciation is what allows me to appreciate the entire world. And if I can't appreciate what's around me, then I can't appreciate God. And my appreciation of all things is crucial to my relationship with and my appreciation of God. And I'll give you just one last example. What's the first thing I start my day with in the day? I don't start my day with a bracha, with a blessing. I don't start my day with a Shemoneh Esrei. I don't start it with a Shema. I start it with a Modeh Ani. The first word in my day is Modeh. What's the second generation? What's the second set of commandments? What's the addition, Leman Yitavlach? What is Tov? In order for you to have Tov, to have good, you have to be able to appreciate good. The second generation are the generation of children. And what Moshe is telling the generation of children is, appreciate where you came from. Appreciate who your parents are. You're about to enter the land of Israel, and you're going to be so focused and so involved on conquering the land, on taking the land, on inculcating ethical values into a place that has lived on pagan values for so long. It's a real challenge. Child sacrifice was the mode in the land of Canaan. Don't forget where you come from. Don't forget that your parents came out of Egypt. They wandered in the desert. You have to take that with you into the land. Because if you want to have good in that land, the land of Israel is called Haaretz HaTov HaZeh. When Moses wants to enter the land of Israel, he says to God, Ebra na ve'eret Haaretz HaTov HaZeh. Let me go in and see this good land.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.